Good morning and welcome to Wanda Speaks, a Black Arts and Culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. Well, we have a really wonderful show planned for you today. We are going to be playing a pre-recorded interview with Haitian-American architect Rodney Leon, who is the designer of the Ark of Return, the design that's going to be representing for the UN a monument to the millions and millions of Africans lost during the Middle Passage. And we had a great conversation with him about maybe 3 weeks ago now. And so I'm really excited about playing that interview with you in its entirety. And if you happen to be in New York, certainly want to catch the 100th or centennial anniversary commemoration of the UNIAACO, the Universal Negro Improvement Association, which kicks off tomorrow at the Schomburg in the evening. So it's really going to be exciting. So it begins on the 14th and it continues through the 15th, 16th, and 17th with events at the Schomburg and also at Megar Evers College. And new events have been added to, looking for the information, Mount Olive's Church, also in Harlem. I'm going to continue playing, well, maybe I won't continue. I'm going to go ahead and just start the interview with Rodney Leon. And we were listening to a little bit of Abraham Burden's Amina.
So I wanted to talk to you about your design for the permanent exhibit at the UN Ark of Return, and now there's actually an exhibit there that's up through, I believe, September 14th, which is looking at Victory Over Slavery, Haiti and Beyond, and that's really exciting. How was the opening reception last Thursday?
The opening reception was wonderful. We were actually part of that reception and also part of the exhibit. We have three panels up in the exhibit that focus on the memorial competition and design.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an intimate space, but it's well attended by dignitaries, including Ban Ki-moon, Secretary General of the UN, and also the head of UNESCO, as well as the head of the African Union and the permanent mission of Jamaica to the United Nations, who happens to be the chair of the Permanent Memorial Committee, was also addressing the opening, people at the opening as well. And my wife had attended along with some other friends and family that I had invited, mm-hmm. and it was very successful.
Oh, that's really exciting. Really exciting. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about the Ark of Return. It was created around the themes of acknowledging the tragedy, considering the legacy, and lest we forget. And within, you know, sort of the piece, you know, Ark, you know, we think of vessels that float on water, travel, fluidity, and just wondering just sort of your thinking around the piece, you know, which is going to be completed next year, I believe, for the 70th anniversary of the UN?
Yeah, it's supposed to be completed next year, sometime in the spring, and we're hoping for it to coincide with the commemorations that occur in March for the abolition of slavery,
mm-hmm.
and it's usually on March 25th. And we're working towards that particular date right now. And in regards to the Ark of Return and what inspired the Ark. Essentially, it was inspired by many things, and one of those things was the idea of a vessel. We felt that it was important to do a certain amount of research, and during our research on the project, we were pretty much fascinated, I think, by the notion of the triangular slave trade in the Middle Passage in particular, and the role that these slave ships played. And in a lot of the research, we saw how the maps of the slave routes and the slave trade routes themselves had such a widespread and significant impact on the transformation of, like, the Western Hemisphere. And, you know, these maps and these ships, and even architecturally looking at the cross sections of, like, a lot of these slave ships and how they were able to compress so many people in such a small, tiny space, and the people had to endure such extreme conditions over many weeks and many months traveling across these vast distances. We felt that, you know, this whole idea of being torn and taken away from your homeland, never to return, essentially, and that being done with these ships, we felt that it was important to kind of come up with a way to acknowledge that, but at the same time create an opportunity for a vessel which then perhaps, if not literally, but spiritually and conceptually, allows one to go back to a place where one's ancestors were, not necessarily physically, but maybe psychologically, emotionally, kind of undo the tragedy of being taken away by those slave ships, and creating an ark and a vessel that allows one, when they pass through, to acknowledge that history, to consider it, and to participate in the kind of like a ritual that cleanses one and allows one to then be able to kind of heal to a certain extent some of the wounds of that tragedy in kind of like an emotional and a spiritual way. So the Ark of Return is about kind of like undoing that in a way through our interaction with the Ark, and through it providing an opportunity to educate people about the experience, and give people an opportunity to be in a space where they can kind of reflect about how it is that we are here today and the sacrifices of those that came before us that allowed us to be where we are. And never to forget, and that becoming important not only because of the past, but also because of the condition of a lot of people that are suffering today with contemporary forms of slavery. And it's through memorialization and through our collective action that I think that, and education of young folks and children, that we're going to be able to continue to make progress in the future moving forward so that these tragedies don't continue to occur. So the Ark of Return really is meant to deal with those three themes of the competition.
Mm-hmm.
And we took that theme, those three themes in a lot of ways, and kind of repeated them and integrated them into the design. I mean, the triangle itself is a three-part figure, and we use the triangle, which is referenced from the triangular maps and the triangular slave trade, as the primary geometric form.
Mm-hmm.
In the arc, and that's how we create the vessel itself through triangulation in the ship's form, and the ship and the vessel is constructed in with three elements that deal with the acknowledgement of the tragedy, consider the legacy lest we forget. The acknowledge the tragedy is aspect of it is really reinforced through the implementation of a map that we have inside the chamber of the vessel that reflects the triangular slave trade route and informs people about that. The second element of considering the legacy integrates a body in state lying inside the chamber that is meant to hearken back to the people who were in the bowels of these slave vessels, but more so reflecting the idea of that soul being taken back to a place which is pointed east towards the African coast. And that idea of kind of like return is implied there, and acknowledgement is applied there as well. And a third element, which is the lest we forget aspect of it, which deals with like the future and the is an opportunity to participate with ritual of water, whether through libations or through some type of a prayer or ablution. We created like a water font and a reflecting pool where one can participate in that kind of like a cleansing ritual, which has many different spiritual and kind of precedents to it. And those three elements and those three actions, those three interactions within the Arc of Return are meant to reinforce that element of like three, the past, the present, the future, acknowledge tragedy, consider the legacy, lest we forget the triangular slave trade route, et cetera. So we constantly kind of reinforcing that.
Wow. This is so, wow, the thinking that went into this work is so wonderful. And when I was just looking at your portfolio on your website and just looking at the beautiful architecture and design of the homes and the homes that you're building in Haiti, you know, for people that were displaced by the earthquake, and then the beautiful palatial museums, you know, for the hip hop museum, and then there's some other work. I'm not on your website, so I can't name it exactly. They're just so beautiful. But this particular work that you're sharing with us, like, do you have a team that works with you to help you with the research? Because I just think about, you know, sort of the triangle, and then you think about, you know, a triangle, the basis of that form is also the pyramid, right? And then you think about the third eye and all these threes, and when we have rituals in African tradition, you say things three times, you know, to make sure that they're closed and they have power with the repetition. And I don't even know, you know, which Orisha might be three. but I was like, wow, this is just so multi-leveled.
Yeah, thank you. I think that a lot of it is that we do have a team of people that we work with in the office, and that help to support us, and we also have a team of consultants that we work with that help to provide technical expertise on different aspects of the memorial, whether that be lighting or water features or stone and engraving and a lot of different things that you know, we can't do ourselves, but we need to work with other people to help to integrate into that. And I think that to a large extent, a lot of, I think, cultural, historical, and spiritual references come from the African diaspora in regards to, we felt it being very important for it to be kind of connected in that way.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of it being inspired and influenced by the, I would say, African diaspora and cultural tradition was one of the prerequisites that we incorporated in terms of like our goals, and not to literally kind of like take something from the past, but to be inspired by it and to create something which is contemporary that nevertheless looks back to the past for inspiration and looks forward to the future. And that's sort of like what it is that we're very interested in terms of cultural contextuality and relevance. And also, I think, in implementation of ritual and spiritual aspects to the memorial, which I think would make it more relevant in regards to what it's really about, which is about acknowledging the death of like so many millions of people. So it has this kind of, I think, spiritual component to it that needs to be reinforced, and so much of African spirituality and tradition is interactive, and we felt that you know, through interacting with the memorial, it becomes more relevant and more African in its essence. And I think we, you know, it becomes like a combination of so many different factors, but kind of coming into like one arc, one design, but nevertheless, you know, the whole becomes hopefully greater than the sum of its parts, as the saying goes.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, through that interaction, we hope to be able to educate people not only about like the tragedy, but also about the history and the legacy of the people that passed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. You're a Manhattan-based architect of Haitian descent, and your work is internationally known, especially in your in New York, your home, where you also designed the African Burial Ground National Monument in Lower Manhattan. I bet that's pretty cool to have your monument in your neighborhood. So this feels like, you know, I live here, and this here is this great work, and this particular work is also interactive and has, you know, a lot of symbolic spiritual references. I think I noticed Ndinkra symbols on the stone, and people can, as sounds like what you mentioned here, that seems to be maybe indicative of the work you do, is people can actually reflect, acknowledge, contemplate, heal, and educate and transform as they experience, you know, this work. And I was wondering how the Ark of Return is a continuation of your vision that perhaps began with the African Burial Ground National Monument. And I'm not sure, I think you've already talked, actually, yes, you have spoken about the philosophical basis of your work. But I was wondering if you can continue talking about that and how that moves, you know, what you do as an artist visibly and thematically.
Well, in a lot of ways, the African Burial Ground is and was, I guess, the beginning of, hopefully would be like a larger journey in terms of trying to make those connections and to memorialize and establish a physical presence for our cultural and our spiritual legacy. And in the African Burial Ground, even though it was a project or is a project that is very specific to a small area in Lower Manhattan, it bespeaks of kind of like a larger tragedy and a larger history and a larger struggle. So we attempted to universalize and internationalize it to a large extent, and to introduce ideas about the diaspora within the burial ground, and tie that to the people, the remains of the people that were buried in the burial ground. And, you know, once we heard about and were given an opportunity to look at the transatlantic slave trade and truly kind of come up with a concept which then could connect spaces and places like the burial ground to a kind of like a larger global diasporan design idea, then I think that, you know, that's something that, you know, we were able to take a lot of what we learned from the burial ground experience and translate that into the Ark of Return and see it as a kind of like more of like a global pilgrimage site to acknowledge slavery's global and the magnitude of the historic impact of it globally. And I think the United Nations Plaza is like an ideal place to be able to do that, in regards to it is already a place where people from around the world, different cultures, kind of come together to acknowledge and issues and to solve problems and to move forward in a way which is collective. And I think that to be able to place a memorial that acknowledges that the tragedy that the slave trade represents is a historic opportunity. And I think that, you know, there's no place better than the United Nations to be able to probably be able to acknowledge this condition. And I'm very fortunate to be able to even live in New York, to be able to be close by, and because it's an international city, and this is like the most international probably building in the most international city in the world. So, you know, in a lot of ways, I think the power of the ancestors and those spirits are actually moving to allow these things to happen, and we're fortunate enough to be able to be the ones to participate in that process of documenting that. And that's one of the things I think that just drives us more than typical kind of like architectural projects which have cultural and historical relevance, and not necessarily like huge buildings, but necessarily projects that are more significant and huge in terms of like their meaning. more than they are about big buildings per se. They're really about important and big ideas than they are about, let's say, physically big projects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I'm just looking at the work that you've created, and I don't know how to speak Creole or French, but the work that you have in Port-au-Prince, that's Le Quiver. Is that how you say it?
Creole Vert.
Yeah, I knew I was
killing
it. Yeah.
Like the green heart.
Yeah, I want to talk about some of your work in Haiti and how, you know, sort of were you born in the United States and your family is from Haiti? Like, what generation are you?
Yeah, I'm first generation American, and my family is from Haiti, and but we've always maintained, I guess, a pretty strong cultural connection, and I've been doing work in Haiti from probably a few years before even the earthquake.
Uh-huh.
And once the earthquake occurred, then that kind of renewed and invigorated my commitment to doing work in Haiti on different levels. Obviously, for the earthquake, we did like a lot of studies and housing for humanitarian purposes. And Le Cœur Vert was a master plan that we did for the government of Haiti after the earthquake to figure out a way to put in place a plan for resettlement for people that had lost their homes after the earthquake. And the idea was to develop a plan around some housing, which would be centered around a large green core where it would act as a kind of like a village center where education can take place, activities such as commercial activities, open markets, places for children to play, soccer fields and playgrounds and those kinds of things can occur in the outdoor, and people can feel like they're part of like a larger community as opposed to being isolated in these little kind of like tents or isolated in these little kind of buildings. So it's about extending that idea of like the community and the village to a plan that would be integrated with not just housing, but other things that people need, you know, jobs, schools, health clinics, and things of that nature. So that project was one of a few things that we've been doing in Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to a large extent it's like kind of giving back, because I think a lot of what it is that inspired us is inspires us to do some of the things that we've done in the burial ground and even in the Ark of Return come from some of the things that I've learned culturally through either studying or learning from my parents and my grandparents about Haitian culture.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing goes with like some of the experience that I've had traveling to like places in West Africa and learning and reading and studying in graduate school about African culture. So
mm-hmm.
in a lot of ways it's kind of like giving back in a way.
Oh, nice. So what did your grandparents and parents tell you about your culture, and where did you go when you traveled in Africa, West Africa? Did you go back to your, ancestral place in Africa when you visited?
Well, when I was growing up, one of the things that we were always taught, there are things that, you know, you're taught just culturally because of the things that you do, whether it's about, like, your music or the food that you eat and the language that you speak.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are things that you're taught more directly about, like, you know, your history. I think, you know, we've always been very proud of being in the first independent black republic that was able to overcome the shackles of European slavery and also creating a kind of like a culture of liberation that helped other countries and other cultures to also fight for their liberation and fight for their freedom in South America, Central America, and at one point even here in the United States. So, you know, that was something that I think stayed with me for many, many years throughout my formative years. And also learning about, the monuments and other things that were constructed around that liberty and that freedom, like the Citadel in Haiti.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there's a rich cultural tradition of the arts as well, and I think that inspires me as well as some of the spiritual traditions as well that are African-inspired in Haiti. When I finished graduate school, I knew that I wanted to spend time in West Africa, and I was fortunate enough to have a good friend of mine, who's still a good friend of mine to this day, from the Ivory Coast, who's an architect who I lived with and worked with, and I was able to spend quite a few months in Ivory Coast with him and do some traveling on our way over there and then on my way back from home in places like Ghana and Senegal. Mm-hmm. And it kind of gave me perspective, I think, in terms of the contemporary expressions of, like, true African culture and how African people are in urban environments incorporating their historic traditions in a very modern way. So that's one of the things that I wanted to learn about and see if I could kind of translate some of that into some of my work when I came back from living and working there. And I think that it was transformative and very helpful experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was, just thinking when you were describing the Ark of Return, that you would have a symbolic, body there, to represent, those lives of these ancestors that, died and, certainly a lot of them lived because we're here. And I was reflecting on, I was in Zimbabwe last year in the summer, and they have this monument. It's like a park, and I think it's the National Heroes Park. And I don't know if you've ever been to southern Africa, but it's just really impressive because all these national heroes, men and women, mm-hmm. they're all buried here, and you can literally, pour libations, as you walk through the park and read about these wonderful people that fought for the liberation of Zimbabwe. And I just sort of reflected on that when you talked about sort of that aspect of being able to mourn and celebrate, within this work. And was wondering, were you also inspired in this idea of monuments and for our heroes and our ancestors through the work maybe of John Hendrick Clark, who talked about how we needed to have erect monuments, and there's a sister, her name is Ann Chen, and she's has the Port Markers Project, the Middle Passage Port Markers Project, and she's in D.C., but she's making her way through all of the ports and coming together with the communities there to see if they want to see how they would envision a monument honoring the people that came into these various ports from the African diaspora.
I'm definitely familiar with John Hendrick Clark and
okay.
to some extent some other historians as well that have inspired me to look at kind of ancient African civilization and the contributions that the monuments that were built and under those civilizations inspires some of what it is that we do. I'm not as familiar with the Port Project, but it sounds like an amazing project. There's also, I guess UNESCO is doing a transatlantic slave trade route project, which is an international project. It sounds like it would be a great addition to that or mm-hmm. to integrate with that, which is, I think, mapping also the slave trade routes and places where people had landed and then began to disseminate African culture throughout the world. So I think we're definitely inspired by monuments, and to memorialize is to, I think, create a kind of like a physical presence and to take ownership of the public space, to acknowledge our history and our culture in a very physical way,
mm-hmm.
As well as in the symbolic and ritualistic way that we typically do. And I think it's very important because obviously it's, these monuments, they stand the test of time over many, many generations, and that's one of the reasons why we try to build them out of stone so that they have this kind of like lasting significance and permanence and scale to them. And I think that that's important. And if you, you know, if you're reading John Henry Clark or Dr. Joseph Ben Yakinen or Ivan Van Sertima or some other African historians, you know, a lot of them do point us to the monuments that were built in ancient Kemet and Egypt and Nubia and other places that we often don't learn about or know about. And I think that, you know, it's up to every generation's responsibility to take on a role of commemorating and memorializing, especially now. So much of our history and our struggles which haven't been acknowledged need to have a permanent, visible public presence, and for us to kind of like take ownership of that, I think, is very important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I was in Zanzibar same summer last year, went to a lot of countries last year, I was in Ethiopia and just seeing those wonderful churches that were built out of a mountainside, and you know, that was
rock cut
churches. Yeah, it's like, oh my goodness. But when I was in Haiti, oh my goodness, the Citadel, oh my God, it's just like so awesome. I mean, just having those kind of structures in your consciousness, I'm sure it does something for you. And as a designer, you know, having sort of this rich legacy to pull on, it's like, it's not over there, it's like inside, it's yours. I'm sure that really like helped you. I mean, you already had like a toolbox full of stuff.
Yeah, I think we do have a rich cultural reservoir from which to draw upon, and I think that we don't do that enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that we're very fortunate enough to have that. There's so much that we can do in order to kind of like learn about how design is connected to, it's not just design for design's sake, it's connected to history, it's connected to culture, it's connected to ritual, it's connected to life in a very kind of like real way. And in that way, people become more interactive with, I think, spiritual objects and spaces in a way that I think that I'm inspired by. And I try to take it to the next step when we're creating a memorial, especially to make it that much more African and interactive and cultural and connected to people. And the hope is that, you know, that it continues and it kind of creates its own ritual and creates its own kind of identity and experience that's unique and becomes adopted as a kind of like an extension of a kind of like a of African experiences and cultures as well. So, you know, we're lucky enough to have not just a Haitian, but also kind of like a diverse African reservoir of cultural references for us to be able to draw from, and that's what I try to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and from your picture, you look pretty young, so you'll be erecting these monuments for, and this wonderful, you know, building these structures where we'll be able to tell, it's like, oh yeah, you know, they have the Rodney Leon signature attached. I was wondering, I was just looking at, you know, you also designed the Museum of Contemporary African Diaspora Arts, and then going back to some of the work you've done in Haiti, you've got the Haiti Soft House, which looks really interesting, and then the work in Jacmel, and then you've got a resort you built, and then you built churches and Islamic cultural centers. I mean, it's like, you know, your range is pretty broad, you know, but one constant is that it's, the work is so beautiful.
Oh, thank you very much. I mean, some of the projects are conceptual in terms of their proposals that have been built, like the Makata Museum. They've been trying to get that land for like a little while.
Mm.
That's something that I was dying to do, the Museum of Contemporary African Diaspora Arts. And also the museum that we did for the hip-hop museum in the Bronx, that one was also a project that we're trying to get the land, the clients are trying to get the land for, and weren't able to do so, unfortunately, in that one case.
Mm.
But we're lucky enough to be able to work on it. We're building right now the Islamic Cultural Center in the Bronx. It's under construction, just finished pouring all the concrete on that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the work in Haiti is ongoing, so we've been lucky to be involved in that for the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully this memorial is going to be completed sometime, like I said earlier, middle of next year or maybe late spring. And, you know, we'll take it like one step at a time. You know, mm-hmm. architecture takes a while to conceive of and to design to, and to construct. So, you know, sometimes it takes years. But at the end of the day, you know, if it's a project like this, it's, you know, it's worth all the time in the world, that's for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the King Emmanuel Baptist Church housing, has that happened? Did you build that one?
King Emmanuel has not moved forward, and we're hoping that we do get them to move forward on that one because it's desperately needed. One of the things that we have is a passion for like affordable housing in our communities, and we think that as an institution, the African American churches are poised and should be the primary movers behind that effort to preserve African-American communities' integrity, especially in the face of gentrification and the rising costs of housing and of everything that is around you. Like New York and is the most expensive place to live in the country, I think, and I think Brooklyn is like second now. So we've been trying to promote housing development for a lot of our church clients. And we're doing one project with a church in Manhattan, which is actually doing a housing development project in partnership with a developer. And they're in about 81% through the first phase of that and about to go into closing on the second phase. And so that they've been able to embrace that vision and benefit from it, whereas I know a lot of times it's harder for some older congregations to learn to transform their vision in a way that will allow them to kind of grow into the 21st century. But I think it's something I definitely have to advocate for, and we definitely have to continue moving forward in that direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then, you know, with your Haiti soft house, I mean, you're using you know real green type of design in the work.
Yeah, we're trying to make that, and I'm doing that in collaboration with three other colleagues of mine.
Mm-hmm.
We're trying to put together a system in place where people can build housing themselves within shelters themselves within a few hours of a natural disaster that's going to withstand the environmental conditions that it has to over a period of like at least 5 years, like hurricanes
mm-hmm.
and floods and earthquakes and those kinds of things, where the tents that typically are given to people in those post-catastrophe conditions are very difficult, to survive those particular environmental conditions. They don't last more than like a few months a lot of times.
Mm-hmm.
But people are in these conditions for sometimes many years. So the soft house is kind of like a reaction to that. And also our biggest concern is like the degeneration of communities during that time when people don't have permanent housing.
Mm-hmm.
And the transitional solution that we have with the soft house, I think, allows people to build transitional communities and maintain a sense of stability for people while they're looking for more permanent housing and getting themselves back together after an environmental tragedy like the one that happened with the earthquake. So, you know, we often lose sight of the fact that, you know, these refugee communities and these camps, they're in a way allowing like the breakdown of like communities to occur over a period of like many years, and we want to find a way to allow people to have transitional housing but at the same time maintain their communities and their strength. So that's really what it's about. And the soft house, I think, is a great opportunity for that to occur.
Yeah, and that would be useful here in the United States because I'm a New Orleans native, and you know,
mm-hmm.
after you know, the levees broke in Louisiana, in New Orleans, and you know, Katrina hit. You know, the impact of Katrina in Mississippi, and specifically, but other places along the the southern coast, I mean, was really, you know, horrific, and people are still reeling from that. And I'm thinking about, you know, those FEMA trailers, which were not that great. The Haiti, the salt house sounds like a much better alternative, and a lot faster alternative as well, because the FEMA trailers, you know, having the formaldehyde pollution and things like that, and then how long it took to get and stuff like that.
They had a similar problem with some trailers that they had submitted to people in Haiti.
Mm.
Yeah, they had the same kind of problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
unfortunately.
Yeah, fortunately, but it's really great you're doing the work you're doing. So I have two more questions. One is about how you decided to go into this this profession, you know, architecture.
Well, I had always an inclination for math and geometry, and I had also kind of like artistic, I guess, sensibility. Mm-hmm. And I also had an uncle who was an engineer and an architect, and I used to see him coming with his tools, his drafting tools, and it always intrigued me, so I decided to look into it a little bit more. And by the time I was in high school, I had taken some architecture courses and design courses, and I felt that I was doing pretty well and I liked it, so I decided to pursue that course of training and have been on that path ever since.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the last question has to do with what we were talking about before I started taping, about Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association, which is 100 this month, July 20th, and the official opening or reception and honoring this 100th anniversary. And when we think about Marcus Garvey, we think about Pan-African, the Pan-African community, and we think about diaspora citizenship. And I was wondering, because throughout all of your work, you know, there's definitely a philosophical through line, and it's definitely reflective of, you know, of you know, who you are in community as a person of African descent. And I was wondering if you could talk about, if you could speak to diaspora citizenship and the Pan-African sensibility, specifically on the Ambassador Tete Antonio of the African Union spoke at the opening reception of the exhibit we started speaking about earlier on in the conversation, that this is the international decade for people of African descent. So, yeah, as a person of African descent in the diaspora, so if you could speak about your work in light of that and diaspora citizenship specifically.
Yeah, I guess I've always, through my, I guess, historical studies and interests, have been inspired to Pan-Africanism. I think probably one of the first people to do so for me was Malcolm X and his writing,
mm-hmm.
in terms of his ability to internationalize our struggle and really communicate the fact that, you know, we do have an African identity which is much bigger than our national identity as American citizens. So at the same time that, you know, I'm African American, I'm also Haitian American, I'm also, you know, a member of the African diaspora. So I always feel, to be quite honest, at home in a lot of different places, and my philosophy is such that I think that, you know, all African people or people of African descent should feel a connection to more than just where they are, but where they come from. And there's a kind of, like, I think a common interest there, and I'm always interested in kind of like making those connections or learning about different African-inspired cultural experiences and African cultures. And you know, that's why, you know, I feel at home when I go to Haiti, or I feel at home when I go to the Ivory Coast, I feel at home when I'm in Harlem or in Brooklyn. You know, so, and I think it's, you know, even the barrier of, like, language or the barriers of geography should not necessarily keep us as people with a shared historical experience from reconnecting with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's something that, you know, in a lot of ways Marcus Garvey and Malcolm X and a lot of others communicated and acted on in very significant ways through the OAU and through other organizations, through the UNIA. I think they're trying to make those connections, and they're doing that through a political mechanism, and I'm trying to do it through an architectural or, let's say, more of a medium of connecting people to architecture as opposed to what they were doing. But I think we kind of all had a similar, in some ways, idea about making the connections. We just had a different way of doing it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
and I was inspired by what they did. Definitely.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm sure they will be really proud of you because your work is just so stunning. Looking now at the Gospel Assembly Church and the folded hands, you know, of the steeple, your work is just so lovely. It's just, oh my goodness, yeah, I'm really happy. I'm really looking forward to your latest public piece. But I'm really happy that the UN, chose you, to represent, our community in this wonderful work that's going to be finished. You said for March 25th, 2015, the anniversary of the end of the document signaling the end of slavery or the importation of Africans into America.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we look forward to the next year, and we're just working away diligently on a daily basis to try to keep things moving forward.
Yes. So can people go to the site and sort of watch you all building it now? Is it going up right now, and people could go and just see how it's coming along?
What we're going to do is put some things probably online as the construction starts. We're still in the design and drawing phase of things, and there's construction going on right now at the grounds of the United Nations for the Capital Master Plan as they prepare for the General Assembly in September.
Uh-huh.
And the site where the memorial is going to be right now is undergoing restoration, which is a big plaza that they're stripping of the old concrete, and they're pouring new concrete. And we won't be able to access that site probably until the end of the year. So we're building our frame and doing a lot of our work off-site. And then we're going to be shipping a lot of the components to the site at the beginning of the year to install it on-site. So we've got to work with the schedule that they have right now, and we have to figure out a way to design and build this thing while the Capital Master Plan is going on concurrently. And so we'll be probably able to install the memorial's structure once the plaza is complete and most of the construction is done there, and we'll have free access to the site then.
Does the stone, is it here, or are you importing any? Is the stone a particular kind of stone that you're using this time, or is it a stone that you always use in your monuments?
We're going to be using mostly marble this time around, and we've been looking at different marble quarries in the Northwest and Georgia and also overseas to come up with the right pattern and the right grain and texture and quality of marble for us to be able to build with.
Nice. But in the meantime, people can check out the drawings and the model at the present exhibit at the UN, Victory Over Slavery, Haiti and Beyond. Is that correct?
That's correct. It's going to be open through the summer at the Dag Hammarskjöld Library, which is acting as the main visitor center, which you can go into the visitor's entrance on 42nd Street and 1st Avenue and access that exhibit.
Okay, super. Wow, well, thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. I've been really excited about talking to you, and it was everything that I expected and more.
Well, thank you so much, Wanda, for calling, and thank you for interviewing me.
All right, look forward to meeting you next month.
Same here.
All right, have a good vacation.
All right, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.